Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Will Hurst, partner with the venture capital firm of Kleiner Perkins Caulfield and Byers, and a former editor and publisher of the San Francisco Examiner and today's moderator. It is now my pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Carrie Beacham, journalist, documentarian, and author of a new book, Joseph P. Kennedy Presents His Hollywood Years. Now, in Hollywood, there is a distinction sometimes made between studio pictures and independent pictures. Studio pictures are sprawling, they tend to center around well-known themes, and sometimes they don't say much we don't already know. Independent movies take more chances, look under the rocks, explore new themes. They are artist-driven, not cliché-driven. Now, sometimes studio talent just prefers to operate in the indie model. And staying in this metaphor, I want to tell you that I see Carrie Beacham as the ultimate indie, but an independent historian, scholar, writer, archivist, archaeologist, indie biographer, a storyteller. It's not that she doesn't do studio work, it's that she does so much more. When we first met, she had finished her biography of the legendary Frances Marion. And I remember her telling a story about how in the early days of the motion picture business, women were by and large the majority of writers of screenplays. And then as the business became more successful, because in the beginning it was considered sort of a fun thing to do but not a real serious business, as the business became more successful, the men came in and pushed the women out. So the point Carrie was making that women's rights, civil rights, are not something that you establish and then it's done. It's an ongoing process which has to be renewed by every generation, or we backslide into the old ways of doing things. As a father of three daughters, I have never forgotten that story. Now, that's the indie introduction. Now for the studio credits. Carrie Beacham is the award-winning author of Without Lying Down, Frances Marion and the Powerful Women of Early Hollywood. She also edited and annotated the book Anita Loos Rediscovered, Film Treatments and Fiction by the woman writer who created Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. She co-wrote Hollywood on the Riviera, the inside story of the Cannes Film Festival. And her book, she wrote another book, Adventures of a Hollywood Secretary, Private Letters from Inside the Studio of the 1920s. And her current project, Joseph P. Kennedy Presents His Hollywood Years, has just been published by Knopf, and I'm sure she will talk to us about it. But we all know Joe Kennedy as the father of a president and as an important business figure, but we'll discover a new Joe Kennedy this afternoon. Carrie wrote the Emmy-nominated documentary film, The Day My God Died, which played on PBS and was nominated for a Writers Guild Award. She has written for Vanity Fair, Architectural Digest, Variety, The Hollywood Reporter, The New York Times, The Los Angeles Times, and various other magazines and newspapers. Those sound like studio credits. She's an Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences film scholar. Her books have been selected for Best of the Year list by the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and Amazon. Before turning to writing on a full-time basis in 1990, she worked as a private investigator. Now we're getting into film noir. A campaign manager and served as press secretary to California Governor Jerry Brown. She lives in Los Angeles. Please join me in welcoming Carrie Beacham.
Thank you, Will. That was lovely, if a little extended, but lovely. And I will treasure that independent label. I like that a lot. Well, today my subject, as Will said, is Joseph P. Kennedy. And I think if we mention the name Joe Kennedy, you might be able to envision this man, the patriarch of the closest thing America has to a royal family. And you can envision a mental picture of him as an older man smiling out from a photograph surrounded by numerous family members, or perhaps he's gaunt and in a wheelchair felled by a stroke. Well, erase those images if you can. Visualize instead a young man in his mid-30s, over 6 feet tall with a slim muscular build, rust-colored hair, and the most wonderful smile. He strides confidently into the room, and his vibrant energy creates a head-turning charisma that commands attention. I asked Joan Fontaine, explain to me, what was this man's power? What was the draw? And she said, oh, he wore his power so comfortably. And he could make you feel like you were the only person in the world who mattered. With bright blue eyes, a frequent laugh, and a tendency to slap his thigh when he was amused, Joe Kennedy was strikingly different from the typical Wall Street banker or studio mogul. This is the man who took Hollywood by storm, at one point running four companies simultaneously, when no one before or since has run more than one. Joe Kennedy graduated from Harvard in 1912. He was hardly the poverty-stricken Irish immigrant he would later paint himself as. He spent a year as a bank examiner, a life-changing experience in the sense that it taught him not to be impressed with the marble columns or thick carpets, to keep your eyes only on the numbers of the page of the accounting books. He then promoted himself to local early fame as America's youngest bank president at the age of 25. No one looked closely enough to discover that it was a small, single-branch East Boston bank founded by his father with $100,000 in capital. Even before he came to Hollywood, Joe practiced his maxim, "It's not what you are, but what people think you are that's important." Marrying the daughter of Boston's mayor was the next feather in his cap, but when banking didn't allow him a deferment from serving in World War I, he was already a fervent isolationist. Joe moved on to become the number two man at a huge shipyard. With the armistice, it was on to Wall Street, where he quickly learned the fine art of stock pooling and short selling. By the mid-20s, he was the father of five and a millionaire chauffeured in his Rolls Royce. Kennedy was first intrigued by films in 1919 when he audited the books of a friendly theater owner. He proclaimed to movies, "Another telephone. This is a gold mine." And he told a fellow broker, "Look at that bunch of pants pressers out in Hollywood making themselves millionaires. I could take the whole business away from them." He would come very close to doing just that. Pants pressers was Joe's euphemism for the almost exclusively Jewish immigrants who had begun as glove salesmen, furriers, or junk dealers, and through hard work, foresight, luck, and timing, were creating the burgeoning studios. Movie making in 1919 was still coming into its own, built to that point primarily by immigrants, women, and those not welcome, let alone allowed in legitimate professions. Joe saw the potential for huge profits when few other bankers understood the business. But for the first few years, he flailed in his investing. He signed the Boston Red Sox sensation Babe Ruth to a film option, but couldn't find any companies to bite. He bought into several production companies that went belly up. He created his own distribution company and then became the New England distributor for Universal's films. By serving on the board of directors of Robertson Cole, a national film distributor moving into production, he learned the intricate ups and downs of the business, and when that company, now called FBO, was at a low point in 1926, Kennedy bought the entire company with money from silent partners, he rarely used his own money, for only $1 million. He would later claim, and most biographers just repeated, that his purchase of the studio was serendipitous, out of the blue, burying the fact that it was the result of seven challenging years he had put into the business before then. It was over those next 4 years, between 1926 and 1930, as Hollywood faced the tumultuous transition from silent films to sound, that Kennedy rose to fame as a master manipulator of the business. Fortune magazine used the metaphor of a chess game to describe his Hollywood climb, taking small pawns such as Robertson Cole FBO and methodically knocking down the knights and bishops of Pathé and Keith Albee Orpheum to create, quote, the queen of RKO in less than 4 years. How did he do it? Well, from the very beginning, Joe operated differently from any other studio mogul. Obviously, there was the difference in origin and background. But for everyone but Kennedy, their companies were their identity. They viewed their studios as their family and had overcome incredible odds to build, brick by brick, a business, a studio, an industry. These men, such as Louis B. Mayer of MGM and Carl Laemmle of Universal, were hardly paragons of virtue. But they did take their roles as leaders in the community seriously, and how they were perceived by that community was a vital part of their self-image. Kennedy alone was untethered by any sense of obligation to anything larger than himself. Another difference was that Joe immediately surrounded himself with a cordon of loyalists who would be his eyes and ears. Eddie Moore, his father-in-law's former secretary who had served four Boston mayors, had been Joe's number one aide-de-camp since the early 20s. Now Joe added other Irish Catholics he had worked with in various enterprises. E.B. Durr, Charlie Sullivan, Pat Scollard were all trained accountants and would each serve different purposes at different times, but they were there to keep the information flowing, assure all transactions were as legal as possible, and know when they should handle things and when to bring it back to Joe. They were willing to, as Dura put it, quote, take the gloves off and get down in the gutter to fight. Collectively, we can lick anybody. They called each other the gang. They called Kennedy boss. It was a clear and simple worldview. If you weren't one of them, you were an outsider. There was no middle ground. And from the beginning, Kennedy revolutionized film financing. He had long known that the credit squeezes and high interest payments every time there was a shortfall had plagued the business for years. So he internalized financing by creating a new company, the Cinema Credits Corporation. Investors were promised a return of 7% annually, and within weeks, $500,000 worth of CCC stock had been sold. With that, Kennedy created lines of credit worth over $1 million at four different banks. CCC was a simple but brilliant creation. The ebb and flow of cash was no longer a concern. It was the equivalent of a private bank providing a revolving fund that kept financing in-house and carefully monitored, the key to putting FBO on steady financial footing. CCC also gave Kennedy total control. There were no external financiers to placate or supervisors to cajole. As Bud Schulberg, the son of Paramount production chief B.P. Schulberg, remembered, all you had to do was say New York to make other studio heads shudder. It meant that they had to justify their spending. It meant trouble. New York was bad news. By creating Cinema Credits, Kennedy didn't have a New York to worry about. There was no one to check with or wait on, let alone to question him. He was New York, and so he was free to concentrate on the task at hand, making and distributing cheap movies at a profit. A new accounting system assured that there was no more money in advance for someone because they thought they might need it. Now, each film supervisor had to provide a weekly accounting of every penny spent under a dozen different categories. Funds were allocated only after expenses were approved and verified, and the gang could be counted on to check and double-check the money that was transferred between accounts. After turning FBO around, Kennedy's reputation was golden. So the money men behind Pathé approached him about taking over that company after he successfully negotiated Cecil B. DeMille out of his contract. That accomplished, Joe became the front man to take over Keith Albee Orpheum, 700 theaters that had been vaudeville venues. But under Kennedy, they were turned into movie theaters, thus depriving vaudevillians of their opportunity to perform. Now, I had always assumed that movies killed vaudeville because it was what audiences had preferred. But what actually happened was that their theaters were taken over by screens and projectors. Joe's next acquisition was First National, a consortium of theater circuits that also produced their own films. At this time, one of the largest film companies, and it would eventually be taken over by Warner Brothers. In fact, it's that studio that's seen today in the credits of every Warner Brothers film. With each transaction, and he kept running each company as he added others, Joe picked up massive stock holdings, at least $2,000 a week in salary, and more companies to pay his expenses and those of the gang. He doubled billed when he could get away with it, and paid for little if anything himself. Even his cabled responses to the sympathy notes he received on the death of his father were billed to one of his companies. Kennedy was profiled in national magazines and newspapers as a brilliant wonderkind, the most intriguing personality in the motion picture world. Luella Parsons hailed him as, quote, the coming Napoleon of the movies, the man, the white knight with the wherewithal to save film companies by merging them and bringing bankers and corporate representatives onto their boards of directors. In retrospect, it's clear that Kennedy was laying the groundwork for today's Hollywood. Now, even he might be surprised to find that United Artists, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, and Columbia are now all partially owned by the same multinational conglomerate. But he's the one who designed that very blueprint. Over 100 films were released under the banner of Joseph P. Kennedy Presents. If he could promote himself and his films at the same time, why not? He was given more column inches in the trade than any other studio head, and was even featured in the fan magazines, big spreads, as the industry's leading family man. He put his picture in company ads, labeling himself as a master showman, and even had his name on the song sheets for his films. As he was being advertised in these articles as this man with his fabulous family, he was conducting his long-term affair with the queen of the movies, Gloria Swanson. And while he would have many affairs during his lifetime, the one with Gloria was the only one that really threatened his marriage. However, after 2 years, Gloria would join the ranks of those he turned his back on. She had seen him as her savior when she came to him $500,000 in debt. But 2 years later, she found herself alone and $1.5 million in debt. And her career never really recovered. Now, there are dozens of Kennedy stories I could share with you this afternoon. I spent years going through his previously unreleased papers. And it seems ironic that it took me as long to research Kennedy, a man everybody thinks they know, as it did to excavate the life of Frances Marion, a woman almost unknown beyond her name on the screen. With Kennedy, I went back to the newspapers and trades of the day and found a few new witnesses and relations who revealed surprises. Gloria Swanson's daughter, who had never spoken to a biographer before, was incredibly generous with me, as was Marlene Dietrich's daughter, Tina Sinatra, Arlene Dahl, Gore Vidal, a variety of people. Now, I read over 100 books and threw most of them out. And let me give you a sampling of why that was true and how I discovered that much of what is considered common knowledge about Kennedy turns out to be urban legend. Now, after selling off KAO and FBO to create RKO, the first studio built exclusively to produce sound films, and pocketing millions of dollars in the process, Joe was reduced to simply being Gloria Swanson's producer and chairman of the board of Pathé. So he started looking around into creating his own theater circuit. He met with Alexander Pantages, one of the last major independent theater owners, and their negotiations went back and forth during the early months of 1929. But eventually, Kennedy decided against moving ahead with his own circuit. That summer, RKO bought six of Pantages' largest theater, and Warner Brothers purchased several others. Pantages' plan was to keep the rest for his sons to manage when he ran into what Variety called a very nasty mess that would haunt him for the rest of his life and tie his name to Joe Kennedy's till this day. Now, just weeks after those sales were finalized, Pantages was arrested in his Los Angeles office Friday, August 9th, 1929, by policemen responding to the screams of one Eunice Pringle, a 17-year-old dancer reportedly in his office seeking work. Pantages was charged with criminal assault, spent the night in jail, and then was released on bail. Headlines were soon reporting every possible scenario, from a violent rape to a total frame-up. Los Angeles District Attorney Byrne Fitz personally argued the case, and over 25 witnesses testified, including an emotionally distraught Pringle. In the process, several of Pantages' witnesses were charged with perjury, with one admitting that the impresario had promised no financial worries for life if he lied for him. Pantages was not only convicted, but at the age of 62, sentenced up to 50 years in San Quentin. Eventually, he was retried, and after dragging Pringle's reputation through the dirt, acquitted. Now, Kennedy's off-and-on meetings with Pantages had been reported throughout 28 and early 29, but several decades passed before the men's names were bound together by Kenneth Anger in his book, Hollywood Babylon. Anger reported that Kennedy had paid Pringle to frame Pantages in order to destroy the man and then buy his theaters for a song. The plot had been revealed, the story goes, in Pringle's deathbed confession as she lay suffering from a suspicious illness in 1933. Now, a series of books and articles followed, each one embroidering the tale. Kennedy had paid Pringle $10,000 and promised her a movie career. District Attorney Fitz was in on Joe's scheme. Poison was suspected in her death. One book went so far as to simply state it had all been Joe Kennedy's idea. So then the story grew like Topsy, like a game of telephone played out on the printed page. And by the time Ronald Kessler wrote his Kennedy book, The Sins of the Father, in 1996, he had Pringle as, quote, violently ill and red in color, a sure sign of cyanide poisoning, on the night she died at the age of 21. Kessler asked, did Joe have Pringle poisoned to silence her? He underscored his assumed answer by saying, the charge rings true, because no autopsy was conducted. Now, I became suspicious of this story initially because the dates just weren't right. I started researching, calling, emailing, and eventually found Eunice Pringle's daughter alive and well in San Diego. And together we put together the pieces of the puzzle. Well, it turns out that no autopsy was conducted for the same reason there was no cyanide nor deathbed confession. Eunice Pringle did not die in 1933. She left Hollywood for San Diego, became a secretary, married, gave birth to her daughter, Marcy, and lived to the ripe old age of 86, dying of natural causes in 1996. Now, Joe Kennedy did many contemptible things in his life, but bribing and murdering Eunice Pringle was not one of them. This is why it's so frustrating as a biographer sometimes, and why sometimes it does end up taking you 6 years to write a book. Joe Kennedy survived the crash of 1929 with his fortune larger than ever. Through movies, he had gone from being worth $1 million in 1926 to at least $15 million in 1930. He had been busy selling his stock in his various film companies in small batches, unbeknownst to the other money men, under the names of the underlings of his various companies, all the way through the middle of October of 1929. The last sale for his Pathé stock was dated October 20th, 1929. Talk about timing. By 1932, he was proclaimed to be the richest Irish-American in the world and was supporting Franklin Roosevelt because, in a situation very much like today, he foresaw that power was moving from Wall Street to Washington. Joe went on to serve as the first chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission. Roosevelt reportedly chuckled to intimates that it takes a thief to catch a thief. But he was proven right. Kennedy turned on a dime and transformed himself from being a Wall Street wolf into a man who instituted the reforms he saw as necessary to save capitalism. Those who had howled at his appointment had to admit a year and a half later he had done a brilliant job. He also served as chair of the Maritime Commission and then was appointed as ambassador to the Court of St. James in 1938. Kennedy was one of a half dozen men to be consistently mentioned as the obvious candidate for president as Roosevelt's heir, until Roosevelt himself decided at the last minute to run for a then unprecedented third term. As ambassador, it was Joe's entrenched isolationism and his tendency to speak his mind that did his reputation in, and he was forced from public life for good. After resigning in 1940, he turned his attention to his son's careers. And when Joe Jr. was killed in a bombing raid during the war, as Jack himself put it at the time, the burden falls to me. Joe was a multifaceted, magnetic charmer, a devious visionary with exquisite timing and more than a glimpse of genius. And there was nothing, including the destruction of other people's careers, that factored into his consuming passion to increase the bottom line of his personal bank account. He put everything and everyone, from Gloria Swanson to Adolf Hitler, through the lens of dollars and cents. Joe Kennedy took what he learned in Hollywood to turn himself and his family into celebrities, and that influenced everything he did from then on, including, of course, his son's election to the presidency. And it was also Hollywood that provided the foundation of Joe Kennedy's wealth. According to Arthur Kroc of the New York Times, when Kennedy left Hollywood, he, quote, had already made so much money that making the rest of it, which must have been many, many millions, was almost a routine affair. As Betty Lasky, daughter of film pioneer Jesse Lasky, put it to me with a trace of awe, Joe Kennedy was the first and only outsider ever to fleece Hollywood. Thank you very much.
So our thanks to Carrie Beecham, journalist, documentarian, and the author of the new book, Joseph P. Kennedy Presents His Hollywood Years. It's time for our audience question period, and we have a number of them here. I've had a chance to look through them. They're great questions.
Okay.
And they're all different, so we'll just
fire away.
Try and get some answers. You alluded to the fact that Kennedy did not come from an impoverished background. What were his family circumstances? Did these influence his ambitious nature?
Well, the other thing I found is a flip to the Eunice Pringle story is that many of the stories Joe himself told had been taken as biographers as on their face of it and then were just repeated. Joe's father was in the state legislature when he was born. Joe was the oldest of three children. He had two younger sisters. His father, P.J. Kennedy, also owned a liquor distributorship, an import-export liquor company, and two taverns. And he was in the state Senate and the state house. He was an East Boston political power. Joe's mother, Mary, was an incredible woman who, when she died, over 1,200 people were at the funeral. She was a suffragist. She was a social activist in many ways. And one of the stories that was repeated to me by someone who knew the family said that Joe, because PJ was in the legislature, he was so well known in the community, oftentimes people would just come and knock on the door at dinner time asking PJ for help with something. And PJ would get up and go help whoever needed it. And that over the years, Joe began to resent that, and he thought his father was way too nice and way too giving, and that his father would have been much better off if he'd just stopped being as giving as he was. I mean, I almost have come to the conclusion that empathy might be a generation-skipping trait, because you look at the Kennedy children and what they've accomplished and their incredible history of public service. And I look back at Joe's parents, and it was the same thing.
Well, that ties right in to this question. How do today's Kennedys view Joe? Have you heard from any of the families since your book came out?
No, I have not. Jean Smith came to a screening of a film and speech that I gave in New York, but she didn't stay to chat. I did, you know, one of the Joe's granddaughter, Amanda Smith, who did a fabulous book of Joe's letters called Hostage to Fortune, was very helpful initially in getting me into the Kennedy papers, as was Arthur Schlesinger Jr. That was the catalyst for me being allowed access to the papers.
What traits of Joe Kennedy, if any, are shared by Ted Kennedy or Caroline Kennedy?
You know, frankly, I can't think of any. I think that I do have to say, I did a piece for Vanity Fair on Joe and Jack, father and son, and I had to tell my editors when they wanted this piece, and I said, you know, I have to tell you, in some ways, the best of Joe is as a father. So if you're looking for something else, you've come to the wrong person. Because Jack Kennedy, Arthur Schlesinger Jr. told me this fabulous story that at one point he asked Jack, why do you think the Kennedy kids turned out as well as they did relative to, let's say, the Churchills or the Roosevelts? I mean, children who really never ever overcame their parents' name. And Jack thought about it and said, well, you sure can't say it was because of my mother. But, you know, Dad wasn't around very much. But when he was, we always knew he had his laser beam on us. And he taught us the meaning of unconditional love. And Jack said, you know, I could stand up and give a speech and fall flat on my face. And my father afterwards would say, yes, but the way you picked yourself up was magnificent. So, you know, that's Joe's dad.
Well, these are two questions that I'm going to merge into one. What, in your opinion, was Joe Kennedy's most humane endeavor, and what was the meanest thing he ever did?
Ooh, humane endeavor. He did do quietly benevolent giving. He was very ecumenical in his giving, fairly limited. There were friends who told stories of him coming in and picking up another son's. He picked up Lem Billings's tuition, one of Jack's friends. He would go just very quietly and without any fanfare pay for several of their children's friends' tuitions and things like that. When it comes to, you know, he really, well, the families of two different people believe that Joe Kennedy forced their fathers to lose their will to live, leaving them so high and dry. Joe's attitude in his dealings with people, I think, could be summed up by saying, if he screwed you, it was your own fault for letting yourself be put in that position. And if he didn't, well, you know, more power to you, but watch your back tomorrow. And all that would be done with a smile. He really just, you know, it really was a bit of a game, the whole thing, including people.
What got Joe Kennedy his ambassadorship? It surely wasn't bootlegging, so was it just political contributions?
Well, he was one of the largest individual donors to Roosevelt's 1932 career, to 32 election. And really, Joe had to wait over almost a year to be appointed to the SEC because Roosevelt, frankly, didn't know what to do with him. I mean, he was hardly a typical New Dealer. He had the reputation as being a Wall Street wolf, and more than a few people were aware of his womanizing and weren't too comfortable with that either. And so I think by the time he became ambassador to England, in fact, Joe told one of his aides going over, saying, now, don't pack too much stuff. We're only going for 6 months. I'm doing this for Rose and the kids. They're going to get in the society columns. They'll all be happy. And in 6 months, we'll go back to Hollywood and make movies again and make some real money. He was still planning on making more money. Now, of course, he ended up staying almost 2 years. And Rose would call it the happiest 2 years of her life. They'd been married since 1914. Joe said, well, I think we gave a total of 10 dinner parties before we came to England. And, of course, once they were in England, it was the one time that Joe and Rose were actually together as a couple, day in, day out. And, of course, for Rose, who'd been raised as the daughter of a mayor and was used to that kind of life, she loved being able to go to the castle and have dinner with the king and queen and Lady Astor and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Was Kennedy's marriage one of convenience to advance himself in society and financially, or was he really in love with his wife?
I think initially, probably before they were married, and you know, for the first few years, he really did love her. They had known each other since they were children together. Her father was the mayor. His father was in the state legislature. They were Boston Powers together. Rose certainly loved him. I think very much she saw him as she was marrying somebody very much like her father, someone who would be proud to have her on his arm, and together they would go to all these fabulous things. Rose had traveled with her father. Her mother was very shy, so it was Rose who went to Europe with her father, who went to the White House, to the Democratic National Convention, to Panama. They had traveled. Rose and the mayor together had traveled all over the world. And she thought she was going to have that same kind of relationship with Joe. In fact, in 1920, Rose is pregnant with her fourth child, and she hears of an affair with an actress in New York. And she leaves Joe for 2 weeks and goes home to her parents. And her father comes in after 2 weeks, and she's literally ignored. Joe doesn't call, doesn't do anything. Her father says, you know, you've made your deal. You've got to go back. That's where you belong. You're no longer Rosie Fitzgerald. You're Rose Kennedy now. And she did. She went to a Catholic retreat and decided, came out thinking, okay, these children are my enterprise. This is what I will do. Joe was known even in college as enjoying chorus girls on the side. So it was not a... It wasn't that he became a womanizer later in life. And you think about the time, it was not that unusual. And, of course, Rose's father was the same. They lived this bifurcated life of, you know, home occasionally with the wife and family and 4 or 5 nights a week out elsewhere. And Joe didn't understand it. When Rose came back, Joe said, Rose, I don't get it. You're a mother. Isn't that enough? I mean, that's what else could you want to be? And he just didn't get it.
The relationship with Gloria Swanson lasted longer and seems to have been important. How did Rose react to that? Did she find out about it?
Well, as Gloria herself put it, either she was a better actress than I was. I mean, I keep looking for another word besides chutzpah to describe this Irish-American. There's got to be one. But he, at one point, has Rose and Gloria and himself and his sister and other family all on the boats home from Europe together. I mean, talk about guts. Unbelievable. He saw nothing wrong with it. And Rose acted as if her public statements were, well, of course Gloria turned to Joe. This poor little Gloria. She was in a financial morass. Joe was brilliant. Of course poor little Gloria was going to turn to Joe. Who else would she go to? And then when Rose wrote her autobiography in 1974, I think, she continued that theme and mentioned poor little Gloria about half a dozen times in the book. And up until that point, Gloria Swanson had turned down offers to write her own autobiography. And according to her last husband told me, that when Gloria finished the book, she threw it across the room, finished reading Rose's book, she threw it across the room and says, that's it, damn it, I'm writing my own book. And she did.
Among Kennedy's activities, which contributed the most to his fortune? Was it bootlegging, the movies, or something else?
I really do believe it was the movies. Now, the bootlegging is another I mean, obviously everybody says, oh, yeah, he was a bootlegger. Now, as Gore Vidal put it to me, and I love this, starting, of course, in 1949, Joe had that little family bank. And as Gore says, what is a bank except a money laundromat? So, you know, he's right. So I don't think, you know, obviously there were a lot of loans and money being passed around. But I really don't see Joe Kennedy rarely risked doing anything blatantly illegal. Now, Prohibition lasted 13 years. And that arc of Prohibition changed quite dramatically during that time. In the early 20s, it was Jews and Irish who were in the forefront of the illegal booze trade. By the middle 20s, the mob starts getting into it. Valentine's Day Massacre doesn't happen until 29. So it doesn't really start to get violent until the mid and late 20s, by which point Joe is in Los Angeles. And Joe isn't one to do anything half-heartedly. If he's doing it, he's present, he's figuring it out. So I just don't think he had anything to do with illegal booze after the middle 20s. However, and this is where this guy, you've just got to tip your hat, I tell you. In 1932, Roosevelt still doesn't know what to do with Joe. So Joe says, okay, well, give me the medicinal licenses to sell booze. Because during Prohibition, in Chicago alone, 300,000 prescriptions were written for medical liquor. Okay, I mean, California medical marijuana, you know, amateur hour, amateur hour. This was an incredible business. And Joe gets these medicinal licenses. He takes Jimmy Roosevelt, Roosevelt's son, with him over to England. This is the equivalent of bringing America's Prince of Wales over to London. He meets with, he gets the exclusive rights to Dewars, to Pinch, to all the British scotch and gin, and immediately arranges to have it all shipped back to America and thrown, brought throughout the country. So on the day, this is, they're signing these deals 6 weeks before Prohibition's lifted. I mean, this guy's timing, impeccable. And so by the time the booze is over and throughout the United States, Prohibition's lifted. And in 1933, Joe has created what he called Somerset Liquors with a little under $100,000, a company he would sell in 1946 for $9 million cash, and who that he used and made money with all those years, including when he was ambassador and shipping space was hard to find for most businesses. It wasn't for the ambassador's booze to go back to America.
Okay.
I mean, you know, the guy's amazing.
All right, this question is, please discuss Joe Kennedy's anti-Semitism. What was the impetus for this?
I think the impetus was cultural. I think the impetus was he was, you know, he was an ethnic Catholic, you know, not a devout Catholic by any matter of means. He was, you have to remember the time. There's no question that he was anti-Semitic. One of the Gloria Swanson's last husband told me that he thought that one of the bonds between Gloria and Joe was the their conviction that Joe would play upon, really, their conviction that they were out to get them. You know, all the Jews in Hollywood were out to get them. And he had a variety of euphemisms, as I'm sure you can imagine. And he had Jewish friends. I mean, he really did. He and Felix Frankfurter, for instance, were relatively close until Frankfurter finally realized some stuff about Joe, and other people as well. But I always have a little bit of a problem with discussing the anti-Semitism because I think people, you know, people will say, oh, well, he was pro-German because he was pro-Hitler. I think he was pro-German because he thought Germany was going to win. And he wanted to be on the German. He wanted to be on the winning side. He really viewed Hitler as an adversarial CEO, someone who could be negotiated with. I mean, it's all about the money. Let's negotiate this. Can't we still make this deal? And yeah, it wasn't nice what was happening to the Jews. But if you really pushed Joe, he would probably have said, "Well, you know, they probably brought it on themselves." And in fact, one of the most appalling things was in 1940, after he's resigned as ambassador, Joe goes out to Hollywood and there's a meeting, several-hour meeting of about 20 of the studio heads. And Joe's talking about selling films to Europe. And he, while he was ambassador, he was very available to all of the Hollywood businesses to keep those films flowing. And he stands up and informs them that you better get those Jewish names off the screen. The Great Dictator had just been released. He said, you keep making movies like that, you're not going to sell your movies to Germany. Now, the Fuhrer likes movies. He wants to buy them. But you've got to keep these Jewish names off the screen and stop making, you know, anti-fascist films. Come on, guys, get with it. And, you know, he really believed what he was saying, and I think as absolutely appalling as what he said was, almost as appalling is that most of them listened to him. Very few objected. I first discovered this whole thing in Hyde Park going through Roosevelt's papers many years ago, his letters from, and Douglas Fairbanks Jr. had written a letter to the president reporting on this meeting and reporting about how appalled he was. And at the time, Kennedy had just resigned, but it wasn't official yet. And Fairbanks was saying, please get this man out of there. You cannot have this man representing your administration.
I remember you telling a story about code phrases, about real Americans in this.
Yes. Kind of Will Hayes, when Joe bought FBO at first, Will Hayes, who Joe had courted, Will Hayes was the Jack Valenti of his day, the head of the what was called the Hayes Office, but the Motion Picture Distributors Association, really the lobbyist for the film business. Will Hayes praised Joe as a real American, honestly American. And what he kept meaning was, you know, he wasn't Jewish. He finally had the joy of having for Hayes and people like that. It was a thrill for them to have a banker become a studio head. Because all of a sudden, this gave great legitimacy to the business. See, we're a real business. We can make people money. We're legitimate. If a fine banker like this Harvard graduate has come in and recognized us.
I should remind our radio listeners, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. And our guest is Carrie Beacham, journalist and documentarian, who is discussing the legacy of Joe Kennedy, the patriarch of the Kennedy family, and she's the author of Joseph B. Kennedy Presents His Hollywood Years. Well, I guess we were inevitably going to get this question. Please talk about Joe Kennedy's relationship with William Randolph Hearst. Oh. And can you compare the two to each other? What did Joe Kennedy think of the movie Citizen Kane?
Oh, he was outraged. Answering the last part of that first. Two movies outraged Joe Kennedy. One was Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. He was ambassador at the time, and he thought it just did horrible damage to America's reputation. And the other was Citizen Kane. He was outraged that they had that Wells had done this to. There should be a law, he said, against making a movie about a living person. So there's no question in Joe's mind who this film was about. And he was also very upset about what he thought the film did to Marion. He was very close to Marion Davies and had a lot of respect for her. But he also said in a letter that I found, and I just love this, he said, you know, you do have to say, it's really amazing. This guy who's never made a movie before, what a hell of a job he did. And these actors, who a lot of them have never been in a movie before, I thought it was interesting because he had never really had a creative eye. You know, tell Joe how much the money made, that was his extent of interest in a movie. But to have him do like this long paragraph, long review, but he was really devastated. He considered both Hearst and Marion friends, and he was outraged that they could do this. In fact, one of the letters I found was to the Hayes office, asking them what they were doing about this horrible thing. Why couldn't they stop this movie from being distributed?
Didn't Marion Davies go to Jack Kennedy's inaugural?
And not only did she go to Jack's and was, you know, right there in the family section. Marion gave Jack and Jackie her house for a week for their honeymoon. She also loaned the house to Joe during the Democratic convention in Los Angeles, and it was perfect because Joe was. I defy you to find a picture of Joe with Jack Kennedy between the primaries and the day after the election. Joe Kennedy knew what his reputation was, and he knew that being physically present with his son would not help him. So he laid very low. And when he came out to Los Angeles, the rest of the family went to a hotel, and Joe stayed at Marion's, which was, of course, the perfect location because any Hearst home had over a dozen phone lines, was very luxurious inside, but quiet and protected on the outside. And that's where Joe spent his week at the Democratic Convention.
What was Joe's relationship with his son, Jack?
You know, I think Jack, well, Rose at one point said, now my theory of parenting is you put all your energy into the eldest and then the rest will follow. So, okay, I only have two, but I know it wouldn't have worked, so God help you with nine. Anyway, so Joe Jr. was the focus until he died. And when he died, he was 28 years old. I think Jack was 26. So Jack, in a way, had the luxury of growing up as a second son. Jack also spent more than a year of his first 17 years in hospital beds. So he learned to become a hell of a reader. He learned to love history. He learned to entertain himself. And while he and his brother, his older brother, of course, had the tug of war of brothers have, but Jack, in a way, had that luxury of not having that infamous laser beam on him, the laser beam that was very much on Joe Jr., until his older brother died.
There's always that story about Joe spending money in Chicago, for example, in the 1960 election. Did you run into
I found him spending more time up at the Calneva Lodge, actually. But he was always in and out, you know, in and out, very quietly, not reported. Of course, there's the Giancana stories, but there's also the Nixon in southern Illinois. And I always would love to know why Nixon really didn't fight it. I'm convinced that, there were things to find on both sides. But I also, and this is pure subjection on my part, but, you know, Joe Kennedy was the one who really insisted that Bobby Kennedy become attorney general. Bobby certainly didn't want the job, and at first Jack wasn't all that thrilled at the idea either. But Joe insisted, and I always thought, you know, what better place to protect you from legal charges than have your brother as attorney general? I mean, and I also have to say that, you know, having spent 6 years intimately involved with this family, as my jaw would drop discovering various things that Joe Kennedy did to people, my admiration for the children just went up incredibly. I mean, one of the things, Joe's papers are, of course, at the Jack Kennedy JFK Library in Boston, so I was also able to spend quite a bit of time with Jack and would have the opportunity of, I'd take a break from the boxes of papers and go down and just watch a 15-minute film of one of his speeches. And, you know, really, I mean, that phrase, the pleasure of his company, was just, it really would refuel me. He was really just a remarkable, remarkable man.
Why did Joe Kennedy get out of the movie business, and how would the family legacy have been different if he'd stayed in?
Well, he got out because, as he would say, you know, the sure way to make money? Sell when somebody wants to buy. And people were buying. And his expertise, really, and where he succeeded in every phase of his life was in all the jobs he had, was when he had a specific task to perform, could zero in on it, rarely over a year and a half in duration. And that incredible time of fear, really, in Hollywood, of transitioning from silence, when they could make these fabulous silent films, into sound, it was, everything was turned upside down. The finances were all of a sudden skyrocketed, the money that was required. Sound films, ironically, require silence. So all of a sudden, concrete buildings had to be built. The cameras had to be wrapped in cloth and housed in little boxes. They couldn't be moved. It was almost a reinvention of the process. And Joe had no patience for that time that was going to take to really shake that part of the business out. He had, in 1919 in Los Angeles, there were over 100 film companies. 1930, there's like half a dozen. It had shaken down. The Darwinian consolidation had taken place. He had done what he could do. He'd pocketed what he could have pocketed.
I should say again that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our guest today is Carrie Beacham, journalist and documentarian, discussing the legacy of Joe Kennedy, patriarch of the Kennedy family. What part did religion play in Joe's life and in his family's?
Well, in his family's. I mean, Rose obviously was a, you know, she would go to Mass daily. The church was, in very many ways, her life. She, as a mother, she would maintain, you know, she is the mother of nine children, there's eight children in 1928, then what some people would call the Gloria Swanson break, and Teddy's born in 32, 33. So the ninth and final child. And Teddy's another one who, you know, my respect for him is so much. And that kid, I'll tell you, so when's he born? 33. They sell the New York home in 37. Actually, I mean, you just get these little fascinating things. 1937, Joe Kennedy changed his legal residence to Florida. Who knew? No state tax, no estate tax. So he bought this beach house in Palm Beach and then had the Hyannis, of course, still. But they sold the big house in Bronxville in New York in 1937. So the children really, although most of them were older by then, lost the only home where they all had bedrooms, specific bedrooms and things like that. And Teddy, at the age of 7 or 8, started on his progression of various boarding schools. And Rose, the other thing about Rose and the church, but Rose would, you know, as I say, go daily. But she also, I learned, was as equally peripatetic as Joe was. Joe would be taking off for 2 months, then he'd come home, and Rose would take off for 6 weeks or so. She traveled a lot with her sisters, with other family members, by herself. She spent a lot of time in Europe, as well as California, not when Joe was here. When Joe was in Hollywood, he leased a house. He lived at the Ambassador Hotel, another little irony. He checked into the Ambassador for about a year. And then as he became more entrenched out there, he leased a house for several years on Rodeo Drive. Think of Joe Kennedy in and out of Rodeo Drive. Okay. Down the street and around the corner from Gloria Swanson's house. But I know I'm wandering here, but I keep thinking of these little tidbits.
We think of the Kennedy family of today as being involved in public service in a lot of different ways. Is there anyone in the family who has Joe's business sense? And who
evidently not. I don't even know the grandchildren. I mean, I know some of the grandchildren. You know, as the family gets larger and larger, of course, that fortune is divided and subdivided and subdivided, so there isn't as half as much as there used to be, although they're clearly all very well off. Not that I know, but it would be in the grandchildren. But they didn't have to. They didn't want to. Now, I have to say, in Joe would claim, you know, he had $1 million trust for each of the kids. Most of them were kept in Delaware accounts, as all of his stuff was. But he started out, and he claimed that he established those trust funds very early on for his kids, so when they grew up, they could tell him to go to hell if they wanted to. They would be on their own. They would be independent. And, I mean, he was clearly incredibly proud of his children. He never said, oh, damn it, isn't somebody going to make the money around here? No, he never did. He was very proud of them.
Here's one for you, Carrie. Right up, who would Joe Kennedy have cast to play himself in a film?
Oh, probably Robert Redford. No, I don't know. 10 years ago. No, I don't know. You know, he would have. Oh, me? Oh no, not me. Oh, twinkle, twinkle, twinkle. And I should say, one of the things about asking about, you know, Citizen Kane and Hearst, I should point out that W.R. and Joe Kennedy met in, I think, 1923 for the first time, and discussing possible merging of different film interests. And they did more or less stay friends through life. Pretty amazing. They were similarly positioned as isolationists in World War II. But Joe stayed fonder of Roosevelt longer than Hearst did. I think he took to calling it the raw deal by about 36, and Joe didn't start losing his faith in Roosevelt until the later 30s. But they continued, and Joe took advantage of Hearst's and Marion's generosity. He was often a guest at San Simeon up at Wintoon, and he and Jack stayed at the beach house down in Santa Monica several times. And the beach house, which is, by the way, about to reopen as a public facility within the next few weeks, I think at the end of April.
Yeah, I think it's coming.
It's very fabulous. Thank you, Annenbergs, for financing that.
Do you see a connection between Joe Kennedy's political opinions favoring appeasement when he was ambassador and later being supportive initially of Joe McCarthy? Do you see that in any way connected with his Hollywood activities?
Not directly, but I mean, he really did believe that America had no business fighting these wars, but it was their problem. They should straighten it out, even though, you know, at various times he would manage to play it financially, so it was to his favor. He really believed it. It wasn't just because of his own personal danger. I mean, he really thought that there was no business. And one of the speeches that he gave, the 1938, when he endorsed under very clear duress, when he endorsed Roosevelt for the third term, and rumor had it, his then lover, Clare Booth Luce, had tried to talk him into coming home from England and endorsing Wilkie. But he did. He supported Roosevelt, and through his gritted teeth, he said, "I'm supporting Roosevelt because I believe he will keep us out of this war." And as he famously said, he said, "You know, I have 9 hostages to fortune," meaning his children, "and I want them to be kept safe, and I think that Roosevelt's the man to do that." And then, of course, you know, when after Joe died, and Joe Kennedy wrapped himself in, he just stayed behind closed doors, devastated, sobbing. And the next year after Joe's death, and he met with, you know, Harry Truman was now running with Roosevelt. And Joe supposedly said to Harry, "How can you have anything to do with that crippled son of a bitch that killed my son Joe?" He was just devastated by Joe's death.
Did Joe Kennedy love the motion picture business, or was it strictly?
He loved the give and take. He loved reporters, and he liked directors. I mean, he was like W.R. Hearst that way. You know, they liked reporters, and they liked other newspaper guys because they're interesting. They've got the good stories to tell. He really did love that camaraderie, and he liked the camaraderie of Hollywood. He liked being able to pick up the phone and call Louis B. Mayer or whoever he wanted to call, and enjoyed that a lot. But most of all, it was such a great financial game to play. He made a run in 1935 at taking over Paramount. His letters to friends over the years, he never stopped saying, "I don't know, you know, I might get back into the movies." And then he'd stop and say, "You know, it's just too much labor. I never wanted to get into anything with too much unions. You know, there's too much of that now." He always had a reason why not, but he continued to be intrigued, and he spent some time as a Broadway producer, produced a couple of plays, much to my surprise, things like that. He loved the idea of being the showman. I think that was part of the reason. I mean, he loved when he would walk into a room with Gloria Swanson. He loved that light shining on him. He really liked it.
So there must have been something about show business there.
Exactly.
Are there any pictures we should see or names write down that are kind of classic Joe Kennedy pictures?
Oh, there's some bad ones. Of course, the one that we haven't even mentioned today is Queen Kelly, which is the film that he and Gloria, as Joe would tell Gloria, "We were going to make this important film, this fabulous film," and it was $1 million was spent, and it was never released. It is available on DVD today, because the first half was preserved. The first half that was filmed was preserved, and then photographs were stuck in at the end explaining the rest of the story. But even that movie, and which is Eric von Stroheim, who directed Greed and these fabulous, incredible epics, but even that film, frankly, when you read the script and the scenario that Kennedy approved early on, your jaw just drops because we've got the virgin convent girl. Here's 30-year-old Gloria playing a 16-year-old virgin. And then the prince comes along and she drops her underwear, and then her aunt dies and she's inherits a brothel in Africa. And you're thinking, Joe, I know you're a good friend of Will Hayes, but this is ridiculous. How could you ever think this was going to get past the censors? And so, you know, $1 million later, it was a fiasco. They did make a very interesting film right afterwards, Eddie Goulding directed, called The Trespasser, which Turner Classic Movies is actually trying to get to show. It turned out to be Gloria's first talkie. She sings in it. And it gets a little melodramatic, but it's very interesting as an example of sound films at that transitionary time, because they used a dozen cameras to record it. The sets walk into each other, and she serves herself very well as an actress and with her voice. She's very impressive in it.
Do you think Joe Kennedy being socially snubbed played a role either in his financial or show business careers?
Yes, and I think that's part of the reason he loved being ambassador, because suddenly he didn't have to apply to any club. He was all of a sudden welcome everywhere. When he was at Harvard, he had tried to, and at the time at Harvard, there were a few Catholics and even fewer Jews, but mostly, you know, of course, it was very, very Protestant, and you don't grow up in Boston as an Irish Catholic and not be aware of the power of the WASPs. And it's interesting because I think not only did he always resent it, Rose seemed oblivious to it. If she wasn't accepted in a club, she'd just start her own. And as long as she was head of the Irish Catholic Women, that's what she cared about. She never quite understood Joe's real resentment. He would say, you know, Harvard, you can go there, but you're still never really going to be one of them. So I think the biggest influence of that snubbing was really he never had any loyalties beyond himself and his family. He wasn't going to trust anybody else larger, and he was going to show them. He wasn't going to just be as good. He was going to best them. He was going to be better, and he was going to show them. And you think about it, having your son elected president of the United States is one big, you know. He was one happy guy.
You've talked in your book about the studio system being invented in some ways by Joe Kennedy. What
I mean by that is not the studio system so much as the financial blueprint for the studio systems that exist today, the mergers of taking these smaller companies and making them into larger ones that could support the financially the films that were being made. He reorganized. He threw out all the independent producers who were working on the studio lot. I mean, why share any profits with the middleman? He streamlined it so that he was going to, you know, every penny was going back into that studio or into his pockets. And by designing the mergers, I mean, he would take 3, 4, 5 companies, bring on corporate, for the first time, bring on corporate representatives of Goldman Sachs. The bankers started to take their place for the first time on the boards of directors of these companies. Thank you, Joe Kennedy.
Well, we've reached the point in our program where there is time for perhaps one last question, and let's try this one. We've talked about Kennedy's going into the business side. Are there any young Kennedys interested in the motion picture or acting side?
Well, yeah, Chris Lawford's been a few things, I think, and a couple of them, of course, Rory Kennedy has, Bobby's last child, has turned into a fabulous documentary filmmaker, very impressive body of work already, and that's what she's doing full-time. And I think a couple of them, I think Max and Kennedy and a couple of others, are sort of working as producers of different films. Quite a few of them are in the Los Angeles area. Bobby Shriver is on the City Council of Santa Monica. And, of course, we all know Maria Shriver is the First Lady of California. So, you know, they're a busy group.
Carrie, maybe I'll ask. What drew you to write a book about Joe Kennedy? Where did this start for you as a
started for me by working scholar. On my Frances Marion book, and very quickly, because I kept seeing, as I was researching and reading film dailies and varieties of the day, my head kept getting turned by seeing Joe Kennedy this, Joe Kennedy that, Joe Kennedy's merging this, he's buying that. I couldn't believe the number of times his name appeared. And so I just started copying those articles. And by the time my research was finished, I had several inches of articles, and I knew there was a story there that hadn't been written before.
Follow the money.
Exactly.
Our thanks to Carrie Beecham, journalist, documentarian. We'd also like to thank our audiences here and on television, radio, and the internet. Remember, we encourage you to continue this conversation by joining us on the internet at commonwealthclub.blogspot.com. I'm Will Hurst, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.